Good morning. It's 10:06. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of WPR. The Mummies of the World exhibit is the largest of its kind anywhere, and it's at the Milwaukee Public Museum for a limited time. So it's a great opportunity for us to talk about this fascinating subject. This hour, we're going to learn more about mummies and about this exhibit from a pair of guests, not one, but two guests here on the Kathleen Dunn program. First, let me welcome Carter Lupton, Section Head of Anthropology and History at the Milwaukee Public Museum. Carter, good morning. Thanks for joining me this morning.
Good morning.
And I'd also like to welcome Dr. Heather Gill-Ferking, Scientific Research Coordinator of the German Mummy Project. Good morning, Heather, and welcome to you as well. Okay, I don't hear Heather.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yes, now I can. Ah, you know, technology is great when it works. Heather, let's start with you. Tell me about this exhibit. How did it come together? Who put this together? Just tell me, how did this exhibit come to be in the first place?
Well, this exhibit actually originated when my colleague, Dr. Wilfried Rosendahl, found a collection of about 20 mummies in the basement of the Reis Engelhorn Museum here in Mannheim, Germany. It was thought that we had them, but they'd been displaced over time, and when he found them, he decided that we needed to research them and then started to prepare an exhibition to showcase those to people in Europe. And over time, the exhibition has evolved a little bit, and now we've been able to bring it to the U.S. through cooperation with American Exhibitions.
Well, Carter Lupton, tell us how this exhibition ended up coming to the Milwaukee Public Museum. How did you pull off that coup?
Well, there's a certain amount of planning and there's a certain amount of serendipity or luck involved with any of these things. Mummies is a topic that I'm personally interested in. We have mummies in our permanent collections at the museum, both Egyptian mummies and South American mummies. And I've done a lot of research with CAT scanning of mummies over the last 20 or 25 years. So it's a subject that I was very interested in. But of course, when these big exhibits do come along and become available and we try to get them, we show our interest to the company putting them together. But sometimes timing just doesn't work out. The venues that they have available and the time slots that we have empty for our space don't always mesh. But in this case, it worked out for both of us, so it's great.
Well, of course, let's talk more generally about mummies. Obviously, that's what the exhibit's about. But, you know, the question I posed in the billboard that teased the show at 9 o'clock, I asked, what's the first thing you think of when I say the word mummy? And for most people, I'm going to venture a guess. When they hear the word mummy, they think immediately of Egypt. But there have been mummies all over the world. Heather, why don't you talk about where all do we find mummies and in which cultures have used them over the centuries?
Well, that's right. We do find mummies from all over the world. And in fact, in this exhibition, we have mummies from five continents. Remembering that mummies come in both natural and human-made forms, and we have a bit of both. So mummies that have been preserved through the environment and mummies that have been preserved through cultures like Egypt, but also there are a number of beautiful mummies that were prepared in South America. We have some European crypt mummies. Many of these were just naturally preserved in the environment.
Okay, so but naturally preserved, they weren't intentionally interred as mummies. It Mother Nature worked that out.
In a lot of cases, a lot of the mummies in South America, it's perhaps a combination of both. They may have used some type of resin or treatment on the skin, but it's very hot and very dry, and so the tissue dries out and the mummies preserve.
Well, I started out with the wrong question. Why don't we define the term mummy? When we use the term mummy, what are we talking about?
Well, this is actually a very complicated question, and even in our mummy studies world, we tend to debate it a lot. But what we've settled on for the moment, at least for this exhibition, is that if it has preserved soft tissue, so if it has skin or muscle or fat or even hair, then we consider that a mummy.
And I was reading some of the literature. One of the mummies, I think it's the one of them in this exhibit from Peru, dates more than 6,000 years before Christ, well before the Egyptians were creating mummies. Talk about that a little bit, too, and either one of you jump in here. Maybe, Heather, we can start with you, and then Carter, I'd like to hear about some of the things that you've been doing with CAT scans and such to learn more about mummies.
Well, the mummy that you're talking about is a child from South America, an 8 to 10 month old child. He is 6,400 years old, roughly, according to the radiocarbon dating, and he is very well preserved. He's so well preserved that when we did the CT scan analysis of him, we can see his heart and know that he had a heart defect, and we can see his lungs and know that he had a lung infection. He also has a very special amulet on his back, a little necklace, and we were able to recreate that in three dimensions, so visitors can actually see a model of the same amulet that is attached to his back that you can just barely see under the bandages.
And Carter Lupton, you mentioned working with CANS and such. Talk about how the new technologies have allowed us to learn more about mummies.
Well, it's kind of fascinating. You know, mummies have been studied with technology as long as technology has been around. You know, original X-rays, or what they called Roentgen rays, back in the 1890s, almost as soon as they were developed, were used on mummies, mostly Egyptian mummies or fragments of mummies. It wasn't always easy to do because that equipment was very big and cumbersome, and it meant taking a part of a mummy or a whole mummy to a hospital. That didn't happen very often. So it didn't really take off until the 1960s, when portable X-ray equipment became more common and you could bring the equipment to the mummy rather than the other way around. But starting in the 1970s, when CAT scans were developed, they started almost immediately to be used by mummies, on mummies, I should say. I got interested in the 1980s with our Egyptian mummies because I knew that some of this work had been done, and ours were actually coming off exhibit for the first time in 20 years, so I thought I'll see if I can get these CAT scans. And we were very lucky here in Milwaukee because GE Medical Systems, as it was called then, now it's GE Healthcare, who builds CAT scanners, they're one of the manufacturers in the world of CAT scan technology, were just outside. They were in New Berlin then. They're in Waukesha now. But I contacted them, and they were very gracious to invite us out, and that was way back in 1986. And we CAT scanned our two Egyptian mummies. At that time, it took a 10-hour day to CAT scan two mummies from head to foot. And we got limited information. You got your typical CAT scan slices, sort of like slicing the mummy like a loaf of bread without actually damaging it and seeing computerized images of these slices. Couldn't do 3D reconstructions at that time or anything. So fortunately, we got to go back there about 4 years ago in 2006 after a 20-year gap with very much newer technology, and did the scans in about 10 minutes each instead of 10 hours, and developed all kinds of 3D imaging and found things out that we didn't even have a clue about in the original scans. For example, one of our mummies named Jedhor, we found in the newer scans that he has actually had a portion of the top of his cranium, his skull cap, removed, and it appears in the scans that if some bone growth has started again around the edges, implying that the individual lived through this operation at least for some days, and this is something that we had no hint of in the 1986 scans.
Is it true that in Egypt, when they mummified someone, that they removed the brain because they didn't think it was necessary for the afterlife?
Usually they removed it. I've seen examples of CAT scan mummies where it has not been removed, but there's been some reason for a relatively hasty mummification. We always say because they didn't know what it was for and had no use for it, we assume that. There are no written records that suggest they preserved the brain, and we've never found preserved brain other than in the few mummies where it wasn't removed. So we assume they had no real sense of its importance. The heart was the important thing in ancient Egypt. So the heart was, they attempted usually to leave in place, although they didn't always have success with that either.
The let's talk about some of the really fascinating. Well, I think I wish I was in Milwaukee right now because I'd love to see this exhibit. Unfortunately, I'm 400 plus miles on the other end of the state. Some of the things about this Mummies of the World exhibit, I want to hear Heather talk about the Orlovitz family. I think that's a fascinating story.
Yes, it is. We have three members of the same family, the Orlovic family from Hungary.
Heather, I think we just lost you.
We have their little and...
Okay, I think, Heather, we're going to have to reconnect because you're kind of cutting in and out. Carter Lupton, what can you tell us about the Orlovic family?
The Orlovitz family is three individuals that are in the exhibit, Michael Orlovitz, his wife Veronica, and their one-year-old child, Johannes. They're from Hungary, from a town called Vach near Budapest, and they're part of a group of 265 burials that were found in the crypt of a church back in the mid-1990s. And it was found that they were at this village about 200 years ago, in the time of Napoleon. The early 1800s had a severe session with tuberculosis, and many of these people had succumbed to tuberculosis. And when this crypt was refound during church work in the 90s, they found all these bodies. They now have been brought to the Budapest Museum, and there's this family of three that are part of the exhibition.
Now, were these mummies that were intentionally created, or were these just naturally preserved?
They were not. They were buried in clothing, in coffins, and then in this crypt in the church. There was no attempt really to mummify them. It was just the natural conditions of a cold, dry air that preserved their flesh.
And
that's a new discovery in the 90s when they found them. They didn't really expect, when they found these burials, they thought they'd be finding just bones, but quite a number of them had their flesh intact.
And, well, let's, Heather, I think we've got you back now.
I hope so.
Oh, okay, there we go. It sounds much better. What kinds of, we were just talking while you were away. I hope you got to hear part of the conversation. We were talking about the Orlovich family and how they were preserved, and there you have several other examples of this kind of preservation. What are the requirements physically for a body to be preserved in a mummified state? What has to happen in order for them not to just become bones?
Well, the first thing to understand is that mummification is such a special thing. Normally, things go through the processes of decomposition, and of course, these bodies don't do that. And that is really highly dependent on a lot of things. If an environment is, for example, warm and dry or cold and dry, that will help with soft tissue preservation. But it's not perfect. Two bodies in the same space might preserve differently, and it's very difficult for us to understand exactly how that happens. We also know that, for example, in an acidic environment like a peat bog, if we have lots of acid and water, we can still get well-preserved bodies as well. So it really is dependent on what we think the condition should be and then a little something extra that we can't explain.
We're talking about the Mummies of the World exhibit. We've got a pair of guests wondering what you think. Do you have questions about mummies? I've already had a number of my assumptions challenged this morning, which is always a good thing. In fact, I've got a sign in my office that's above my computer that says, "Challenge your assumptions." This is very healthy for me today, learning a lot about this exhibit and about mummies in general. Maybe you've got some questions, things you'd like to know about the exhibit itself or about mummies. We have the experts here to answer these questions, and I'll give you the phone number to call to join the discussion, 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's a different number than you normally use for the Kathleen Dunn Show, so I'm going to give it again, 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org always works. And you can find the Kathleen Dunn Program on Facebook and join us there as well. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR. 21 minutes after 10 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. I'm trying to remember who I'm filling in for. Sometimes it's really confusing to be me. Here's what's coming up later on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. After 3 on Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders, Veronica Rickert is in for Gene Faraca and talks with film critic Jim Hoberman about foreign films to put on your must-see list. That's after 3 o'clock this afternoon here on Earth, Radio Without Borders. This hour, we're talking about mummies, and I have a pair of guests with me who are experts. There's a Mummies of the World exhibit is now on at the Milwaukee Public Museum. It'll be there through, I believe, May of 2011, but it's there now. You can go see it. And I have two guests. They are Carter Lupton, Section Head of Anthropology and History at Milwaukee Public Museum, and Dr. Heather Gill-Ferking, a scientific research coordinator of the German Mummy Project. And we have callers who want to join us. Let's start. We'll talk to Reed first. Reed, good morning.
Good morning. I have a number of questions, but I'll try to limit these. As a child, I was always interested in and remember Ripley's Believe It or Not articles in newspapers and comic books and whatnot that talked or showed drawings of shrunken heads. And I was wondering if shrunken heads have any relationship. It's a form, I would suspect, of mummification. The mummification of animals, of course, we're perhaps more familiar with Egyptian mummification of animals than any other culture. I didn't know if other cultures did that as well. And the last thing I would like to say, and please forgive me for saying this, but we here in Clintonville, and that's where I'm from, are not all as mean-spirited as Arlene in the previous hour. Thank you.
Okay, Reed, thank you for the call. Shrunken heads, are they a type of mummy?
They are, I guess. There are none in the Mummies of the World exhibit. They certainly have soft tissue preserved. The shrunken heads are usually found among the Jivaro Indians of South America, Ecuador and Peru, and we have several in our permanent displays at the museum, but there are none included with the Mummies of the World exhibit itself. But shrunken heads, of course, are only shrunken because they've removed the skin from the skull first. You can't shrink the skull, but you can shrink the soft tissue. And then they're kept as trophies by the people who have defeated their enemy.
Heather, what about the mummification of animals? So were there other cultures besides the Egyptian culture that practiced this?
Well, there are certainly animals mummified from all around the world. Most of these are natural mummies. So one of the animals that you'll see in the exhibition is a 500-year-old dog from a peat bog. That's like the bog mummies from Northern Europe. And it still has all its fur and all its fluff. It's just a number of natural mummies. But in terms of intentional mummification of animals, that really wasn't practiced by a lot of some beautiful llama mummies that exist from South America. Llama fetus mummies that exist from South America don't have those in the exhibition either.
Okay. Carter, talk a little bit about the Egyptian cat mummy that's in the exhibit.
Well, there's actually two cat mummies in the exhibit. One is in a side of wooden coffin, sort of, but the one that's beautifully wrapped is in linen bandages. The Egyptians, of course, mummified almost every type of animal known to them for a variety of reasons, but the large mass of animal mummies in Egypt are usually considered as votive offerings to different deities at different temples, so there will be a place where cat mummies are found in large quantities, or ibis, a water bird mummies, or hawk mummies, or fish mummies, or crocodile mummies, because the Egyptian gods were usually associated with these various types of animals. And so at a temple that's dedicated to a crocodile deity like Sobek, you would find crocodiles raised and mummified. There's a baby crocodile mummy in Mummies of the World. Most of these animal mummies in large quantities are found in the late periods of Egyptian history, the Greco-Roman periods primarily, and that's when you get very elaborate wrapping. The cat mummy that you mentioned is very elaborately wrapped with linen bandages that make these beautiful diamond lozenge patterns in the wrappings. And you find human mummies wrapped in a similar style for that period, that late Greco-Roman period. It's very beautifully done.
Do we know why the Egyptians started this elaborate process of preserving their dead? What was their purpose?
They obviously believed in an afterlife that had many of the elements of this life from a very early era, before there were pharaohs or pyramids or any elaborate Egyptian civilization. We find the simplest pre-dynastic burials going back to 3,500, almost 4,000 B.C., where bodies are simply buried in pits in the sand, but they're usually buried with grave goods. They've got pottery, they've got weapons and tools, they've got things like this. So obviously they believe they need these things, and there's some kind of existence they're going to have in the afterlife. And at the site where I used to work in Egypt, at Hierakonpolis, Rene Friedman in recent years has found some of these pre-dynastic burials that even have a very primitive early form of
I don't quite want to call it mummification, but an attempt to preserve the burial. There are linen bandages wrapped around some of these early bodies, and obviously the very beginnings of this process, a good 5,500 years ago.
Okay. Well, let's. I want to go back to the phones because Carol in Green Bay has a question that I was thinking of asking earlier, but I think it's better if Carol asks it. Carol, good morning and welcome.
Good morning. I had a question. When you were talking about finding that family in Hungary, or a number of the bodies there, it put me in mind of when some scientists were able to find a couple of young soldiers, I think it was, who died of the Spanish flu. They were looking for DNA, some to try to figure out what the virus was. I think it was when we were all worried about that bird flu becoming a pandemic. When you find bodies that are naturally mummified like that, is there? Do you take infection precautions? Are you concerned that you might bring up something that may no longer be a problem here?
Yeah, Carol, it's a great question because when we were talking about those Hungarian mummies, I think TB was mentioned. So what about it? Is there a Carter Lupton? Is there a problem when we deal with these, because soft tissue is preserved? Is there a problem with disease?
Well, there might potentially be, but I think I'm going to let Heather answer that because she was more involved with those Hungarian mummies.
Heather, I think we've got you back now. We've been having a little bit of telephone problems.
Hopefully we've got me now. Can you just run through the question for me again?
Carol was concerned because when we were talking about the Hungarian mummies, and you had mentioned that there was a lot of tuberculosis and so forth, and she was talking about how... Carol, are you still with us?
Were you concerned that we might be unearthing something that's no longer a problem and might become a problem again, bringing these bodies to the surface?
Actually, we weren't too concerned about that. I am aware of some diseases that will sit dormant, for example, in frozen soil, and we've had, for example, influenza show up from permafrost soils. But in terms of the mummies that we work with, we really weren't too concerned about diseases that could come out and be a threat to the public. Certainly, most of us, when we handle mummies, we're very cautious about how we do it. We will often wear gloves and, if necessary, a face mask. And we have all of our mummies, all of the mummies in the exhibition, have been very carefully checked for signs of disease or even fungus that might potentially be a problem for people. So we've worked very hard to make sure that these are safe.
All right, Carol, thanks so much for your question. Let's go to Monford next, and we'll talk with Eileen. Eileen, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My question is somewhat tangential to Carol's. I was just wondering if they are able to determine, like, cause of death, and speaking more of the older mummies, like the Egyptian mummies, and did things like heart disease or diabetes or cancer exist in during that time period? Were they able to tell?
Yes, we do have examples of a number of those diseases. In fact, there is a research project by somebody that I'm aware of in Wisconsin that looks specifically at heart disease in Egyptian mummies, and we know that certainly has existed. We're aware of cancer in a number of mummies from the past, so these are not new diseases. Diabetes is a little trickier to try and identify, but we have certainly identified a number of mummies that have diseases such as tuberculosis, as I said, cancer, heart disease. All of those things certainly seem to have existed.
Can I just add something? Heather mentioned this doctor. This is Dr. Samuel Wan of the Heart Hospital, Wisconsin, here in Milwaukee. And he has been studying and CAT scanning mummies at the Cairo Museum, looking at heart issues. And he will actually be one of our speakers on March 6th in our lecture series, Connected with the Mummies of the World.
And the Milwaukee Public Museum has a website. Why don't you give that to us?
That's www.mpm, Mary Peter Mary. .edu.
mpm.edu. And the Mummies of the World exhibit, I believe, the traveling exhibit, that there's a website for that too as well, isn't there, Heather?
Yes, there is. There's mummiesoftheworld.com.
easy to remember. And if my producers will remind me, I'll mention both of those before the end of the show in case people want more information. I'm sure they will. Let's take some more phone calls. Eileen, thank you for that. Let's go to Darwin in DeSoto next. Oh, a little alliteration. I love that. Darwin, good morning.
Good morning. How you be today?
Pretty good so far.
My question is, basically the Incas in mid-America, well, below Mexico, South America, really, were the families, when the head of the family died, was the rest of the family put to death and buried with the head of the family? Because I know that reading history books, that the slaves were, and all the prisoners were, and I'm not quite sure on how far they carried this social procedure over.
Well, I'll make my comment and then see if Heather has anything to add. There are a number of archaeological cultures around the world where you seem to see evidence of some sacrifice of retainer burials. When a high-level individual dies, they may sacrifice other people to be buried with them. We see it in very early dynastic Egypt. We've seen it. I used to work down at Cahokia Mounds, Illinois, in North America. We saw it there in some of the burial mounds. You see some of it in early Shang, China. But it usually doesn't last for a long time into a culture because it's very wasteful of individuals to kill people just as retainer burials to go with a high-status individual. So you might see it as a ritualistic thing early in the development of a complex ancient culture, but usually it doesn't last for a long period of time.
Heather, right. You want to add to that?
Yeah, from my knowledge of Incan social rituals, I'm not aware of members of the family or even extended family being included in any of those sacrifices at all, no. We should have more mummies if that's the case.
Yeah, that would be true. Darwin, thanks for that call. Lines are now open for you if you'd like to join our discussion about mummies. It's All Things Mummies here this morning. We had All Things Political, now we're having All Things Mummies. I'm not going to speculate on which hour was more interesting. I'll get in trouble if I do that for certain. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's the phone number to use to join our discussion. You can also send us an email. The address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page and leave a message there. We'll pass it along to listening audience. We had a listener, Kathy, who could not stay on the line but wanted to know if Lenin is considered a mummy, and if not, what kind of preservation process is the one that's used to keep him preserved?
Lenin is actually considered a mummy. He's considered a category of political mummies along with Eva Peron. The specific process used to preserve Lenin is not pretty well understood. A lot of that information has not trickled out from the East. There's some general information that tells us they use essentially fungicides and a few other chemicals, but the specific chemical recipe has really not been revealed.
Political mummies. I didn't realize that Eva Peron had received that level of preservation. I guess I should have paid more attention. We've got callers starting to line up. That's a good thing. A couple more things here about the exhibit specifically. Talk about some of the other features of the exhibit, some of the things that people will really be interested to see. We've mentioned some of them, the Detmold child, the Orlovitz family. How about a couple? Let's talk about some more of these European mummies, because I'm fascinated by this. Baron von Holtz, a 17th century nobleman. His situation, how did we discover this mummy?
Well, the Baron von Holtz is part of a collection of five mummies from a family crypt in southern Germany. We've had the opportunity to study three of them so far and have brought two for the exhibition. And the living descendant of these mummies still lives today in that castle and allows us to study the mummies, and actually traveled to Los Angeles when the exhibition was there to see it, which is a nice thing for us. He's taken part in some of the research. We don't know the Baron's cause of death, but we do know that he had an extra backbone in his spine, which is a little different. And we also know that he has these amazing leather boots that come up to his knees. He never had the chance to wear them in life, but they were put on him in his death. And these are beautifully constructed leather boots with diamond-shaped nail heads. So for us, it's very interesting to see the mummy, but also be able to talk to and work with the living descendants. And the second mummy from that crypt is also very, very well preserved. And we've just recently studied her CT scans to discover she has a very, very badly curved spine, which is the same with the third mummy we've looked at. So now we're looking at reasons why these people may have had problems with their spines.
You know, Baron von Holtz had plenty of backbone, maybe too much.
Absolutely.
I could not resist making that bad joke. Let's go to Duluth and talk to Stephen. Stephen, good morning.
Yes, hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I had a question about bog mummies of Northern Europe. I recently read in a Swedish newspaper that Caucasian people are not indigenous to Northern Europe. I was wondering what the bog mummies tell us and if politics, you know, ever gets in the way of anthropology.
Well, fortunately, I am one of the specialists in bog mummies in the world. I'm one of about six people in the world that get to work with them, so I can probably answer this. In terms of identifying a sort of race, these are essentially Caucasian people. These are northern populations from about 2,000 years ago. While some have come from southern Europe, others have come from northern Europe. So they are essentially Caucasian people. And yes, politics does sometimes interfere. I did a lot of research in northern Germany where it's still very difficult to talk about physical anthropology because of some of the things that went on during the Second World War.
Stephen, thanks. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Dan in Appleton next. Dan, good morning.
Yes, good morning. I have a question. I don't want it to sound silly, but I was wondering if these mummies were to be resurrected in their bodily form that they were preserved in, how were they supposed to release themselves from their basically their linen bondage there?
So would they come alive in the afterlife, and how would they get out of the wrappings and out of the buildings that they were interred in?
You're talking about Egyptian mummies here, apparently.
Yeah.
The Egyptians didn't believe so much that you got to remember that the Egyptians had a very different outlook on what makes up a human being than we do today. Essentially, they had about seven different elements of what makes up a human entity. One is the physical body, the corpse. Another are there various aspects of what we would call souls or spiritual aspects. There's a ka, which is a double. There's a ba, which is another type of spiritual entity. There is the shadow. There is the name of the person. These are all elements that make up a complete person. The ba is the mobile one. The one that we believe is usually depicted as a bird with a human head, and the ba is the essence of the human that can physically leave the tomb, supposedly, which is why it's depicted as a bird in flight. But it's a magical leaving. It's not a physical. They never believed, like you see in the movies, that the body is going to sit up and unwrap its bandages and walk around. That's all from the movies and from novels. The Egyptians' belief in the afterlife was in a sort of a magical spiritual existence. They could be nourished by food, but again, they're nourishing from the essence of the food. They're not physically eating it. So even depictions of food stuffs on the walls of tombs is enough to nourish them throughout eternity.
Heather, you want to add anything to that?
No, I think Carter's actually summed it up very nicely. I think, again, as Carter said, the Egyptians didn't visualize these people kind of taking on a physical presence in the afterlife. They viewed them as having this spiritual presence.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Scott in Madison next. Scott, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm really enjoying the conversation. And essentially, my question, which is a good follow-up from the last call, is why am I enjoying this so much? There's such a wonderful, morbid fascination with the subject matter, and I really look forward to seeing the exhibit. And I'm curious for your guests to maybe talk about what is it about the subject that they're really fascinated with, or why we as a whole are fascinated with mummification and this burial process.
Well, I suppose Heather and I have different answers, so I'll give you mine, and then she can give you hers. I've been interested in ancient Egypt for many, many years, and originally I was not particularly interested in mummies. I was dealing in pre-dynastic Egypt. I actually sort of ignored mummies when I went to other museums. I only became interested in ours in the mid-80s when I had this opportunity to CAT scan them and to work with them. But, you know, being an archaeologist, everything in archaeology is about humans and human culture, but mostly you're dealing with objects that they've made or buildings that they built or things that they wrote, and not with the people themselves. It's all about what the people did, and it's trying to get clues about the people, but you're very seldom dealing with the people, even when you're digging up burials that are skeletons. But when you're dealing with mummies, you are face-to-face with those individuals, which is the ultimate purpose of archaeology. And I think, for me, that's part of the fascination. With other people, I think part of it is just that they are humans, they are preserved. You can come face-to-face with them and face-to-face maybe with your own thoughts about your mortality.
Heather, why are you so interested in mummies?
I would tend to agree with Carter a lot on this. I think, for me, it's very much a case of, as a biological anthropologist and archaeologist, I have the chance to tell you the story of this person that we're sharing with you. So every body that I work with, they're telling me a story, and I love the opportunity to be able to share who this person might have been, what they might have eaten, how they might have lived. It's this small window to one tiny little bit of the past that I have access to and have the privilege to share. And I stop and remember often that 500 or 1,000 years from now, these mummies will still be here, and I just might not be.
We're going to take some more phone calls. We've got some emails to respond to. Scott, thanks for that call, and we'll do all that in just a moment. I just want to remind you, we're talking about mummies. The Mummies of the World exhibit is now at the Milwaukee Public Museum, and you can find links to the websites that we've mentioned on the Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page. So that means... it'll be easier for you to find them there than for me to repeat them, probably, but we will anyway. We're talking about mummies of the world, mummies in general. You can join the discussion at 800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org, or you can also find us on Facebook. As I said, leave a comment there and we'll pass it along. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR. It's just about 10:45. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later on the Ideas Network, holidays and tough economic times don't sound like a good fit, but at issue with Ben Marins after 5. Ben's guest says that this is a good year to embrace the holiday spirit. That's at issue with Ben Marins from 4 to 6 today here on the Ideas Network. This hour, it's all about mummies. Carter Lupton, Section Head of Anthropology and History at the Milwaukee Public Museum, is one of my guests. The other is Dr. Heather Gill Ferking, Scientific Research Coordinator of the German Mummy Project. We have callers who want to join us and some email to respond to, so let's get to it. We'll go to Krivitz and hear from Cookie right now.
Hi.
Cookie, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I'm not sure I like the idea of human beings being on display. You know, there are laws against digging up corpses, and if you want to dig one up, you have to have a court order. Do you have people who object strongly to seeing human beings, even if they're 5,000 years old, being on display?
I think there are certainly some people who will object, and they're certainly entitled to that, absolutely. If you're not comfortable with it, or if you're not comfortable with the idea of how this has happened, then perfectly understandable. In this case, and certainly speaking with mummies that we have in the exhibition and the ones that I normally work with, these are ones that have normally been excavated as a form of protection. For example, their site has been endangered by construction or something else, and if we don't remove the mummies, sometimes they get sold on the black market, which I obviously don't approve of, and sometimes they get damaged or destroyed, which is also not a healthy thing. So if we're going to have the mummies, I think we have a scientific responsibility to study them, which we do very respectfully, so that we can share the knowledge of that culture or the knowledge of that preservation. So I would agree that there are a lot of people who think displaying mummies is not a good idea, but I think there are also a lot of people who benefit very strongly and feel that it's an important thing. Certainly in Germany, where we display the bog mummies in northern Germany, the people there feel very much that it's their heritage and it's their chance to share their heritage with other people. And that seems to be the response that we've had from a number of people.
I'm going to add my thoughts from a museum perspective. I've worked in a museum for 35 years. And when we have formal requests from groups of descendants of any ethnic group that doesn't want any of their human remains on exhibit, we, of course, honor those requests and remove them from exhibit. However, to just make the decision that no human remains can be on exhibit is putting myself, I feel, in the position of setting the morals for the rest of the world and telling you what you can and cannot see. In fact, something like this happened recently in England, in Manchester, England, where they have a large research devoted to Egyptian mummies and a large exhibit. And they actually covered some of them up in recent years, and they got more complaints from people who wanted them on exhibit than they did ever from people who didn't want them on exhibit.
Cookie, thanks for that call. We have an email from Carson in Lake Geneva who says, I understand that Abraham Lincoln is essentially mummified. I read somewhere that when his coffin was opened in 1901, he was completely recognizable and well-preserved. Is this true? Is Lincoln a mummy?
It's news to me.
Yeah, I was going to say, if that's the case, I'm not aware of that.
Okay. All right. Well, we also had a caller who had to drop off. Dave wondered about how to care for mummies. Wants to know about the proper, quote, care and feeding of your mummies. I would imagine that that's a pretty significant undertaking to maintain that preservation. Carter, why don't you go first and then Heather?
Well, generally, if mummies have been preserved for several hundred to several thousand years, they are dried out enough that they're not usually going to absorb any more moisture. There's just not the tissue structure there, and the moisture is usually what causes the decay. So if you keep them free from vermin, from pests and insects, and just keep them in a fairly stable, dry environment, I don't think you're going to have too many serious problems with continued preservation.
Heather, right, you want to add to that?
Yeah, we had to make some very special considerations in order for these mummies to travel. These mummies have been collected from 20 institutions, museums, and universities in Germany. And so for them to be cared for to travel required some very special planning. And all of our mummies were thoroughly checked. And part of the work of the German Mummy Project, we do research, we share the information, and finally, we do conservation on the mummies. So we check to make sure that they don't need to be repaired, that they're not going to be damaged by transit. We check for things like mold or fungus or sometimes insects, which can infiltrate the bodies. So all of that is part of the long-term care of the mummy. And in fact, when the mummies are returned to Germany at the end of the exhibition in 2013, they will all be checked again. Every time the crate is opened, we monitor that mummy very carefully to make sure that there aren't any changes or damage to it, and we monitor the temperature and the humidity during the exhibition to see that there's no further breakdown. Just because something has been preserved for a couple of thousand years, as Carter said, if you keep the environment stable, it's fine, but we need to make sure that that environment stays stable.
Okay, let's take another phone call. Larry in Eau Claire, you'll be next. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning. When you walk through the Vatican in Rome, there are a number of former popes on display in glass caskets, and I wonder if your guests know how those are preserved. They look very nice, and so maybe they have an insight on that.
Again, I think there are different methods used for different popes at different times, and some have worked better than others. Some I know have had a wax infiltrate type base, so something, it's like an embalming system, some that are very heavily wax-based and others that are pure chemistry-based. So it depends a lot on the time period, and I would agree, some of them look absolutely marvelous, but they, again, have to be monitored very closely and sort of touched up to make sure that nothing will happen to them in the long term.
Would they be considered mummies?
I think they're considered mummies. There's soft tissue there.
Yeah. Okay. You know, it's interesting. There's a catalog that accompanies this exhibition that we have available in our gift shop, also called Mummies of the World, and it's quite large and quite detailed. It has some 60 articles in it, papers on all aspects of mummies, including even some discussion of popes and of Lenin and of Eva Perón and all these topics we've talked about. So people that want to know a lot more information, it is available in print.
We have Tom in Wausau couldn't stay on the line. It's our day for people who had to come and go. But he wondered, who owns the mummies? Does the Egyptian government want their mummies back? How do politics play in? Let's start out with who owns these mummies, Heather?
Well, again, our mummies in our exhibition come from 20 different institutions or museums that have care and responsibility for them. We don't really refer to it as ownership. It just isn't appropriate to own a person, whether living or dead. So we don't refer to that as ownership. We refer to it as stewardship or even curatorship, that we care for those mummies. They're in our care. There are some cases where there are requests made to have mummified bodies returned, and that has certainly happened with some of the Egyptian material, and Carter can probably speak to that more than I can. But in the case of all of the mummies in our exhibition, they are held in care by various institutions, including a number of them at my museum.
Right. With Egyptian mummies in general, there are so many of them around the world, museums all over the United States, all over Europe, many, many other places, as well as in Egypt itself, they're in museums. There hasn't been calls for significant amounts of repatriation of mummies. In very rare individual cases, a few years ago, Emory University in Atlanta repatriated a mummy that they had acquired to the Cairo Museum because they had some reason to believe it might actually be a royal mummy, and so they were glad to work with Cairo to return that to Egypt. But that's a pretty rare case.
Tom, thanks for that call. Is there a misconception about mummies that we haven't talked about yet? I think we probably dispelled most of the myths. But is there something that you really wanted to make sure that we got out there, a piece of information that we haven't talked about yet?
Well, for me, I think there's a misperception that mummies are all creepy, or that they're all scary. And I really think that's not the case. I think everybody sees something different in a mummy, and many of them are very beautiful. When you come face to face with a woman who's 800 years old and has tattoos on her chest and braids in her hair, and you see the expression on her face, or any of a number of other mummies, I really think that there is no creepy feeling to this. So I think just the fact that they're kind of scary and creepy, and I've worked with mummies for years, as has Carter, and I don't think Carter has ever had one come back to life, and I know I haven't, even working in museums long after midnight. So these ideas are out there, and I think it's important to walk away from those ideas.
Carter, what about you? What haven't we talked about this morning that you really wanted to be sure that we mentioned?
Sort of the same thing. There is this sort of separate modern folklore or urban myth about mummies. Mummies have become, through novels, through movies, through children's books and things, through Halloween, have become almost as common as ghosts and vampires, as little things that spooks that come out on Halloween to scare you. And there's a whole subgenre of work on that, whether it's children's stories or cartoons or movies or whatever. But that is, as long as you can separate that and keep that separate and say mummies aren't really like that, it's fine. But it's when you start to believe that, yes, there are curses of pharaohs. Yes, there were curses in Egyptian tombs, but they weren't curses that said the mummy's going to rise up and kill you if you desecrate my tomb. They were the same kind of curses as if you didn't like me or didn't want somebody invading your space and say, I'm going to hope you go to hell or be damned because you have disturbed my tomb or because you've hurt my family or something like that. But that's a very mundane type of curse in comparison to what they show in the movies.
Well, of course, I'm of a generation that would have considered the mummy one of the quartet of famous monsters, along with Frankenstein, Dracula, and the Wolfman.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, we have Hollywood to thank for at least some of our misconception about what mummies are. Well, we've got just a few minutes left. I want to talk specifically. Let's talk about the mechanics of the exhibit. Not everyone who listens to this program lives in Milwaukee. What's the best way for people to interact with the museum? How do you get there in terms of where is it in Milwaukee? I would need to know that. I get lost every time I drive there anyway. I'd probably take a cab. But and what are the hours of the museum? How do we go there?
Well, the museum is located right in downtown Milwaukee on Wells Avenue, 7th Street in Wells. And we do have what do you call it, timed entry for this exhibit, as we do for most of the temporary exhibits. So you can either go to the website that we've given you, mpm.edu, or you can call the reservation number, which is 414-223-4676 to look about getting reservations for a time to come and see the exhibit. We have a parking structure right adjacent to us, MacArthur Square parking, so it's fairly easy to accommodate that. We're only a couple blocks off the freeway if you're coming from the south or the north or the west. You can't be coming from the east because that's like Michigan.
Yeah, I promise not to arrive by ship.
Yeah.
I think this is a fascinating subject. When our producers brought this to my attention, I thought, okay, well, you know, this might be an interesting hour. So the Milwaukee Public Museum, the exhibit goes through the end of May. Is that correct?
Right. And we're open from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. most days. Usually the entry to the mummy exhibit is an hour and a half before the museum closes. So when we close at 5 p.m., the last entry to the exhibit is at 3:30. On the weekends, we will be open later in the evenings. I'm not sure the exact hours, but you can check those reservation numbers. And on weekends, we will be starting valet parking as well on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, I believe.
Okay. Well, we have we will have links on the WPR program page. Go to the Kathleen Dunn program page, and you'll find links to the websites that we've mentioned here. Also, they'll be up on the Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page shortly after the end of this program. I want to thank both of you for a fascinating hour here this morning. Heather and Carter, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
For taking time.
Thank you very much.
Carter Lupton, Section Head of Anthropology and History of the Milwaukee Public Museum. Dr. Heather Gill-Ferking, Scientific Research Coordinator of the German Mummy Project. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning, and we had Erica Janik handling on-air production duties this morning. Thank you. Thank you so much to both of them for helping make this an easy day for me. I'll be back tomorrow with more. I'm filling in for Kathleen all this week. Please join me tomorrow morning from 9 to 11. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.